Today's program is brought to you by the Museum of Food and Drink, sparking curiosity about food with exhibits you can eat. For more information, visit mofad.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum from the Brooklyn Kitchen. Join me every Wednesday as I talk with people about what they do and how it influences their personal food stories. This is a show about people, life, and food. Please take a moment to like the show on iTunes if you like it, and please reach out if you have any questions or comments. You can reach me via email, harry@thebrooklynkitchen.com, and you can follow me on social media at TheFoodBaller. I want to start today's show, which is number 72 of Feast Your Ears, with something that I'm going to try out, just mentioning something I cooked this week, every day or every week at the beginning of the show. So this week, what I wanted to talk about was natto, which we'll get to later in the show. I'll talk with my guest, Ryan Carney, about natto because he spent a lot of time in Japan, but I made some natto at home. I tried out making my own natto from adzuki beans, which are small red beans. They're a little bit sweeter than soybeans, which natto is traditionally made from. And natto is an alkaline ferment. So that, if anybody is listening, is interested in natto, alkaline fermentations are somewhat rare. Mostly when we're fermenting food, it is much more acidic, sauerkraut, vinegar, things like that. And in natto, the bacteria actually makes the beans more alkaline, and that is what preserves them. And if you've never tasted natto and you want to, I will be serving natto at the Break Festival. I'm trying to figure out how to say that. Break Festival. The breakfast festival that Extra Crispy is hosting on June 10th in Industry City. So we're going to set up there with a photo booth that will take your picture while you're tasting natto for the first time. And then you can have that and put it on your social media. So we're going to try that out. So today, my guest is Ryan Carney. Ryan is the co-founder of Kinfolk. That's Kinfolk with a backwards K at the beginning of their logo, not the matte-covered, perfect-bound magazine of the same name, but we'll talk a little bit about that later. Ryan created Kinfolk as a place to hang out with his friends, essentially, and at the time, he was in the aerospace business and was tired of punching the clock, so he traded that career for crunching different numbers in terms of budgets and food costs and beer costs and things like that. Kinfolk now has expanded and has its own clothing line, bar, nightclub, cafe, and more here in Brooklyn and until very recently Tokyo, and we'll talk about what happened with the Tokyo space as well. Thanks for coming on the show.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
So, Ryan, let's start with what is Kinfolk?
Well, Kinfolk has changed over the last, I think we've been in business now for 10 years.
Congratulations. That's a big milestone.
Yeah, thank you. It started out just really being like a project-based design idea. A group of friends got together. We were kind of sick of what we were doing. At the time, we decided we all had different skills. We could put them together as kind of a collective and start projects, creative projects of some sort. And some of them, you know, we never knew how long they would last. Some might last a week. Some might last a month. Some might be, you know, we didn't have an idea. It was just like, we want to do project-based creative projects. And so, you know, we started a couple. They didn't work. They worked. We ended up, one of the first ones that caught on was we wanted to make bicycles. And that came from the idea that we were traveling back and forth to Japan, picking up used Karen bicycles that at the time were really undervalued in Japan and overvalued in the U.S. And
got it.
We could go buy a bicycle for $300 and come back and sell it for $700, and that would just pay for our plane tickets and our food and lodging while we were there. And it was just kind of a way to hang out and go back to Japan because Maceo McNiff, my partner, him and I at the time had a long history with Japan. We've been going to Japan for 10 years, 15 years almost, at that point. And so we just had a lot of friends there and a lot of connections. We both had lived there in the past. So this was just a way for us to kind of enjoy what we were doing. And so that was the first project that kind of, you know, became more than just, you know, a couple day thing that we were doing for making t-shirts or whatever. And we ended up, at the time, we were buying these used bicycles and we found a builder, an old Japanese bicycle builder, and we talked him into building frames and under our name, and we didn't have a name at the time. We came up with Kenfolk, so we started the Kenfolk Bicycle Company. That was our first real creative project.
And where were those made in Japan?
They're made in Kobe.
Cool.
And they still are today. We actually use a different builder than our original builder, Kusaka. We use a builder by the name of Ryzen. But the quality is the same, and you know, we don't make as many as we used to. It's kind of something that has lost steam, not in the sense that we care less about it. It's just focus is elsewhere, and it's kind of the niche project, and people come to us two or three times a year and we build a little bicycle.
But got it.
So it
started with your interest in Japan. What led you to Japan initially?
So it's kind of a long story, but a very interesting one. Basio, myself, and my really good friend Jameson, I actually didn't work for Katsu, but Basio and Jameson worked for a friend of ours in Portland, Oregon. We were all living there at the time. This was 1995, I think. Named Katsu. He's still there in Portland. He has a place called the Compound Gallery in downtown Portland, a couple other businesses. He makes these really beautiful scarves out of old Japanese fabrics that he reclaims. So they were working for him at the time, and his business back then was importing, exporting of goods. He would mostly export like Levi's and shoes. Nike shoes were big in Portland. The company's based there, so right. You could find really rare Nike shoes like at thrift stores and things. So like they would buy these, you know, he was buying Levi's and Nikes and all these vintage clothes and shipping them to Japan, and then he would take Japanese toys and bring them back and sell them in the U.S.
Right.
So there's a lot of going back and forth.
Because the anime and manga thing had taken off here, but there weren't people really importing the specific toys and things from there. It makes sense. I mean, the sort of on-the-ground economic trade of it is fascinating to me, because now, right, I mean, fast forward to 2017, almost anything you can just get.
Right.
You could just pull out your phone.
Yeah, there was no internet back then.
And be like, I want this thing from Japan, and if you're willing to pay for the shipping, you can have it. It's not hard.
Yeah, I mean, he's probably one of three retailers in the U.S. that had it, this stuff, you know? And,
yeah.
And it, you know, I don't know how people would get into it, but the toys are weird. You know, they're very, like, you know, some of them were very sexual and some of them were very violent and weird. And, you know, it's like Magna is weird. It's just, like, off cultural from the U.S.
Yeah.
So people who were into it were very into it. And he had a very good business. And so there was just a lot of going back and forth because no one wanted to pay import tax. No one wanted to pay shipping. And so he started sending all of us to Japan.
Ah, so you guys were essentially, you were like clothing and toy mules.
Exactly. So, you know, did that for a couple years. And
so you'd fly from Portland. You'd go to Japan with a suitcase filled with Levi's and Nikes.
Right.
And then you'd like meet a guy and like trade for toys or.
There was, yeah. He had partners in Japan and, you know, sometimes you'd stay for a week. Sometimes you'd stay for a couple of days. And, you know, after a while you got to know people and made some of the greatest friends ever and actually spent a lot of time there. And the funny story that I want to mention that brings me back to Natto.
Sure.
It was the very first food I ate when I was in Japan, and I got picked up from the airport, Narita Airport, and drove into the closest konbini, the closest 7-Eleven or whatever it was, and the guys we got picked up in like a Volkswagen bus kind of thing. And they were like, well, you can only stay in Japan or ever come back if you like this one food. And they're just playing a practical joke because nobody likes
Nacho.
Because
Westerners hate it.
They hate it.
Yeah, Westerners all hate it.
And I'm like, you know, and I have a pretty strong stomach. And
sure.
I'm like, okay, fine. And I ate it, and I really liked it. And they were all so upset that I actually liked the food.
I guess I should explain a little bit for listeners who may not know about natto. So in the fermentation of the soybeans, the bacteria create this like snot like stringy texture to the beans, and in the West we just like that is not a texture that we are used to eating at all. Yeah. And it sometimes has a slight ammonia smell to it, and just it's something that people generally, Westerners, look at it or taste it or smell it or see it and they're just like, bleh, I don't want to eat that. I also really like it. The first time I ever ate it was in Nagoya, and I went to a restaurant for breakfast alone. I like went to a ryokan, and I got up in the morning by myself, and I like went out, spoke almost no Japanese. And I went to this cafe, and I saw someone else eating it, and I was like, natto kudasai. And they looked at me like they thought I said the wrong thing. They didn't think I really wanted to try it. And then I like pointed at this guy's dish, and I was like, kore, kore. And so they brought it to me, and they were like, I could tell that everyone who worked there was kind of like eyeing me for my first bite to see what I thought about it.
Yeah. There were the six of us in the van. They all turned around and looked at me like, are like expecting me to just throw it up or like spit it out or whatever. I was like, oh, this is actually kind of good. Yeah. The texture, of course, it takes some getting used to, but the taste is excellent.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one thing I often tell people is that, like, you know, it is often dressed. I mean, the Japanese are incredible with the stuff you sprinkle on food, whether it's spicy or a flavor or a condiment or whatever. So there's a lot of things that sort of can go with natto that change it from just being this mass of like snotty beans.
Yeah. My favorite's like the spicy mustard.
Yeah. Totally. So you were going back and forth to Japan a bunch, and you made a bunch of friends there. Mm-hmm. And then as Kinfolk expanded, I mean, you mentioned to me right before we started the show that the Kinfolk bar that was in it was in Nakameguro, right in Tokyo, that is now closed recently. But what did that come first? Was that the first physical space of Kinfolk?
Yeah, that was. That was the first physical location. And we, in creating this bicycle company, we were there a lot, and we said we needed a place to hang out. We need a showroom. We need somewhere where people can go and look at these bicycles. So a friend of ours somehow was connected with this other guy who was leaving town. It was a Westerner who was leaving town, but he had built out in the top store of an old Japanese building, like a house, a bar. And he just had it as a clubhouse. And so I was like, well, that's kind of a good idea. We'll just have it as a showroom during the day and sit there and hang out and drink beers at night.
Perfect.
And then we realized, wow, this kind of works. And people started coming more and more, and there'd be five people a night, and then it turned into 10 people a night. And, you know, it wasn't very big. I think max capacity is 25 or 30 people.
And it was on an upper floor, you said?
It was on the second floor.
Yeah.
In Nakameguro, which is a really a very Williamsburg type neighborhood.
Sure.
Tokyo. And it just turned into this like cultural hub of Tokyo for the time, and everybody, or a lot of people who'd come in from out of town, whether, you know, who were into the creative industries, artists, musicians, designers, would all stop by and kind of see what's going on in Tokyo. Kind of became a, you know, concierge to the Western world there for a while, and it helped that, you know, Nike and Adidas all had creative studios in the neighborhood. And so it just kind of became, it was a hub, you know, of people at the time. It was great. And so, unfortunately, buildings in Japan don't last very long. I think the average lifespan of a building is 15, maybe 20 years. And this was a 50-year-old building. It was really cool because there wasn't a single nail in the whole building.
Wow.
It was all tongue and groove type joinery, Japanese joinery. So it's sad to see it go, but the land owner decided that, you know, I there might even be a government stipulation you have to get rid of buildings of certain age.
There's a, I forget where it was. It might have been Freakonomics. One of those radio shows, podcasts like that, did a show a couple of years ago about real estate in Japan and how, unlike here where we hold on to old buildings and there's a lot more value to old buildings, in Japan it's the land.
Right.
And so very often in Japan, when someone buys a piece of property, they tear down the old building and build a new one. And they said, I think the average cycle is like 15 or 20 years.
Yeah. And actually, the interesting thing about that is that building, like, a piece of property with an old building on it is less valuable than a piece of property has no building on it,
right?
Because it costs a lot of money to get rid of, you know, to get yep. rid of that building.
Yeah.
So it's like it has actually, you know, negative value. So
right, whereas here you can't buy an empty lot with help from the bank.
Right.
What the bank wants is the building.
Right. Exactly.
Not the land.
Yeah. So it's gone. The building was torn down about four months ago. We're considering going back out there. But, you know, we now have kind of set a standard or a precedent of having more involved spaces.
Sure.
And we can't really go back into a space like we had done before. So going back and doing another space would take a lot more effort than the first space took. And, you know, Japan's very expensive and there are complications with operations. So we're just taking our time.
Yeah.
And hopefully we get back out there. And if not, then, you know, it was fun while it lasted.
Tell me about your spaces in Brooklyn. So you have two
right
next to each other on Wythe Avenue between North 11th and North 10th Street.
Yeah, so I was living in Japan at the time, and Maceo was living here in Brooklyn, and we both have a mutual friend, Paul, from Colossal Media, who we've been friends with since the early 90s in Portland. He's from Portland as well. And Maceo was sitting out there drinking beers because Paul's Colossal shop is across the street
right.
from our space on.
And anyone who has been in New York City in the last 10 years and seen a hand-painted billboard on a building, it
right.
pretty much was painted by Colossal.
Correct, yeah. So they were out there, like they still do today, drinking beer after work, sitting in the opening of the warehouse, and he saw a real estate agent walk across the street and put up a for lease sign. So when the real estate agent left, he walked over to our town and called the next day and secured a lease on North 11th and Wythe, and called me up and was like, hey, I secured a lease. I need the money to pay for it, and I don't know what we're going to do with it. And I'm like,
But we have the space. Right?
But we have the space. Okay. And I'm like, oh, that's great. You know, what neighborhood is it? And at the time, there wasn't much over there.
Right.
It was pretty bleak. It was kind of the thoroughfare between Greenpoint and Williamsburg. That was kind of a plus, but there was nothing, no retail, no bars, restaurants, hotels.
What year was that? You guys got that
this
lease?
Was 8 years ago.
Okay, yeah. So they had, I guess, they had just started to build the East River State Park, like to take that land over from it. It was just an empty field. And yeah.
Right. Brooklyn Brewery was still there, and Brooklyn Bowl had just opened.
Right.
They had broke ground on the hotel. The Wythe Hotel is just broken ground. So I was like, okay, cool. Well, I guess I'm moving to New York. Packed my stuff up, moved to New York, and we spent the next year figuring out how to get enough money and resources to build out at the time, which was still is a cafe and lounge. So that was our first spot. And we've done quite a few food pop-ups in there over the last 8 years. Currently, we just started a new one. The guys from Kichin are now serving food over there.
Oh, nice.
So they're doing like a Korean-style fried chicken.
Oh, awesome.
And bento lunch. Oh, that's great.
Oh, it's open for lunch.
It's open for lunch, yeah.
I gotta come by.
We're doing lunch from noon to 6, and then we will do late-night food on the weekends. And then eventually we'll start doing brunch and dinner.
That's rad. Yeah, I mean, you guys have sort of incubated a bunch of people that have gone on to other things, right?
Yeah.
You know, Asuka started there.
Right.
Yuji Ramen started in your space, so.
Yeah. And that was kind of the initial concept was, hey, we want, you know, with this space, we want to be an incubator of ideas.
Yeah.
And, you know, being a bar and a cafe and a food establishment, I don't know anything I don't know a lot enough about food to cook it. So at least for somebody else, yeah. That's not really close to me. So we just reached out, and we kept reaching out to people, and we just find people who were passionate about what they did. And so we'd bring them in, sort of incubate them. And we did, you know, Maharlika, which was a Filipino food. I'm not actually sure if they're still doing it now, but they were our first, and they did it for about 6 months. And then Yuji Ramen and Frey, which was the first incubation of Asuka.
Right.
They did it at the same time, and then we ended up changing it. Frey changed their name to Asuka, and they went on to get a Michelin star in our space, and now they have their own restaurant, and Yuji moved on to have his own space too.
Yeah.
So it's great. So I'm hoping that, you know, these Kichin guys take off, and it's great. You know, I'd like to keep them for a little bit longer just because it seems like a really good fit for us.
Right. Yeah, it seems to fit. You'll get more people in for lunch and then give you the opportunity to do late night when the bar is really hopping.
Yeah, exactly.
And then next door to that, you have a clothing store and an event space.
Yeah. So when we first moved in, we were there. We got it open, and there was an art gallery next door, and I love the space. The space was like this big open warehouse with 20-foot ceilings and just really vast open space. And I was always in my mind, I want that space. And the gallery ended up, after we were there for about 2.5 years, moving back to the city where they had originated from. This was like an outpost where they'd have larger pieces. And the landlord, you know, allowed us to move in, and, you know, we got some funding and built out an event space, and part of that event space, the front of it, we did a clothing store. So at that time, that was the time when we started, okay, well, we kind of have a following for this like creative, you know, conceptual company that does a bunch of weird stuff. None of it really gels or makes sense together, but they do, you know, every once in a while they do something really cool. And so we just said, hey, let's make some t-shirts and hats. And a good friend of mine, Jay Perry, who I met while he's in Japan, he's working for some clothing companies, decided to come on and take over building a line of clothes for us. And then so we were like, hey, well, if we have clothes, we might as well have a retail shop to sell our clothes.
Yep.
And bicycles now. And so, yeah, that's kind of how the space evolved.
Cool. We're going to take a short station break and hear from one of our sponsors here at Heritage Radio. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more. I want to talk a little bit more about growing up, where you grew up on the West Coast, but now you're, you know, entrenched in New York.
Okay, great.
I'm Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network. We all know and love Chinese takeout dishes like General Tso's chicken and egg rolls, but here's the thing. Even though we call it Chinese food, it's not like the food you'd find in China. What's the story behind this cuisine, and how did it become so popular that you can find a Chinese-American restaurant in nearly every town in the country? The answers may surprise you. Visit the Museum of Food and Drink in Brooklyn and see our newest exhibition, Chow, Making the Chinese-American Restaurant. Chow engages visitors with compelling accounts of how Chinese immigrants overcame racism and created Chinese-American cuisine. Discover the science behind the flavors of your favorite takeout dishes, feast on rotating tastings developed by the country's most talented Chinese-American chefs, and try your hand at writing your own fortune, which will be baked into actual cookies by a 1,500-pound fortune cooking machine. What better way to learn, connect, and eat? You can visit Chow at the Museum of Food and Drink on Fridays through Sundays from noon to 6. Tickets and more information can be found at mofad.org.
Welcome back to Feast Your Ears. It is Wednesday, May 24th, and I'm here in the studio. I like to sort of think of, sometimes I think of the studio as a fishbowl. Sometimes I think of Roberta's as the fishbowl. We're sitting next to the sort of indoor-outdoor, what was once a yard behind Roberta's with a, I think it had a Mercedes, like 240D sitting here, something like that, was sitting on the ground there. But anyway, we're in the back of Roberta's at Heritage Radio Studios, and Ryan Carney from Kinfolk is my guest today. If you're just tuning in, we talked a little bit about what Kinfolk is and does, and now, Ryan, I want to ask you a little bit about your personal history. So you grew up in Bakersfield, mm-hmm. and then moved to Washington, and sort of were sounds to me like you were very entrenched in the West Coast, and now you're in the East Coast. So can you talk a little bit about growing up in Bakersfield and what that was like?
Yeah, I was born in Olympia, Washington. Got my grandparents and aunts and uncles and majority of the family still live up there. When I was six, my family moved to Bakersfield, California. So I didn't really know much of the Pacific Northwest as a kid. Spent a lot of summers going up there. Most of my upbringing that I remember is from Bakersfield, which the day I graduated high school, I left town, and I didn't really appreciate it, and now I actually really appreciate going back there. My parents still live there. I appreciate it as a town. You know, it's not a very pretty town. It's
right.
Actually quite ugly, yeah. And there's not much there, but... It is really central to a lot of other places in California that are quite beautiful.
Yeah,
it's not that close to the ocean, but it's fairly close to the ocean. It's really close to the mountains that are really pretty up in Kernville and the Kern River.
Yeah,
but growing up in Bakersfield was interesting. Skateboarded, surfed when I could make it to the beach, listened to mostly punk music. And you know that there weren't many of us, which
right.
was cool.
Right.
There was probably a group at my age of 40 to 50 of us, and we all were spread out all over town, all went to different high schools. In fact, I probably had very few of my close friends actually went to the same high school. But every day after high school, we'd all meet at the same park and sit there and hang out until the sun went down, then we'd go home and we'd do it again the next day. But it created a really interesting dynamic with us as like this, the skater kids. And, this is skateboarding wasn't very popular at the time because it had its 80s, explosion. And, the early 90s, it was kind of still dead. So there wasn't a lot of people into it. And it created this great friendship with people that I'm still really close with, because there wasn't, you were either a farmer, farmer, cowboy, or a construction worker, or an oil field worker. That was like all Bakersfield had. So there's just this weird like outcrop of weird punk kids who skateboarded, and nobody even knows what that was at the time. There weren't skate parks. Your mom didn't drive you to the skate park. You kind of went to the, you went to the park and made your own ramps in friends' backyards and stuff. So, and a lot of my friends at the time were into bands, and, Bakersfield actually, there was a couple people who, locally, who brought a lot of really good bands into town. Surprisingly, I got to see, like Fugazi play at the high school gymnasium and,
nice.
And things like that, which was like really random, but there weren't big auditoriums. So,
yeah.
And these bands would always stop because it was in between San Francisco and L.A.
Right, and San Francisco to L.A. is actually a pretty long haul if you're going to do it in a single shot.
Right, yeah, so we were always a stopover, so we got to see a lot of good stuff. Bakersfield, it was interesting, like I said, I got out. Everyone did. I guess I have some friends that stayed around, but most of them either went north San Francisco, went south to Los Angeles. And I think there's very few of us who actually ended up out here out east.
Interesting. Are any of those people involved peripherally? Like, do you still run into them in the kind of world that you've created with Kinfolk?
I don't. There's not. I think there's four or five. There's four or five of us who are here, and they're all off doing their own things. It's cool, Everyone came out here for a purpose.
Yeah.
And so, everyone's been, successful in the and the venture that they came out here for, because right. you kind of have to be, you know, yeah. kid from Bakersfield who's kind of, it's, you know, Bakersfield's kind of a weird, it's like kind of country, kind of suburban, zero culture unless yeah. you're into country music. You kind of just have, you know, you get immersed in New York and you're like, what is this? We didn't, you know. It's just completely different from anything we grew up with.
So do you consider yourself a New Yorker now?
No. I don't. You know, I've been here. My first stint was back in 98, 99. I lived here for 2 years. And I left back to California to go to college. And then I've come back. I came back out here now, and I think I've been here for 8 years. And my heart's still out west, and I love it out here, and I spend a lot of time in the outdoors here. But I imagine at some point I will probably head out back west. It might not be California, but it'll be, you know, west of the Rockies.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a thing that happens out there where your access to the outdoors is different than yeah. your access to the outdoors here. And the outdoors there is so much bigger. It's I feel like fast, is what it really yeah. is what it really is about. Because you can get, I mean, you can get to, you know, you can get and go hike part of the Appalachian Trail from New York without too much, you know, trouble in less than an hour or so, hour and a half, depending on traffic. Like, it's right. not that bad. I mean, you know, right. if you're going to the mountains from Bakersfield, like really into the mountains, you know, it's an it's hour, hour and a half. It's about the same amount of time. But right. but out west, you're covering a lot more mileage in that hour and a half, I feel like.
Right.
And you're getting to a wilderness that's way bigger.
It's way vast. Yeah. 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 I mean, I spend, you know, I get out of town probably once a week. Me and my close group of friends now, we're really into riding dirt bikes. So that puts us out in nature.
Yeah.
But it's also, you know, 2 hours to get anywhere where we can do that.
Where you can ride, yeah.
And so that, you know, it's, you spend 4 hours in the car to ride 4 hours. It's a little bit weighing on, and not weighing on the experience, but on the availability of doing it.
Yep.
You know, you can't just be like, okay, I'm going to go out for a couple hours and come back. You've got to really make a day of it. And, you know, as you know, running multiple businesses, you don't always get that much time yeah. free. So, but yeah, I love it here. I'll always have, there'll always be a part of my heart that'll be here. And I'll hopefully always have, you know, a place that,
cool.
you know, I consider New York somewhat my home. Yeah.
Did you have any more time to think about the question I emailed you before the show? If you could have dinner with anyone, who would it be?
You know, I actually, funny, I was taking a shower this morning, and I was like, I know he's going to ask me that question. And I figured out why I couldn't answer it. I think it changes a lot. And
sure.
I think, you know, it's funny. At the like, and I was like, well, who would it be right now? And unfortunately, I'm not sure if you know who he is. Nikki Hayden is an American motorcycle racer.
Yep. Yeah, just passed away.
Just passed away. So if I was going to answer that, ask that today, it'd be him.
Be him, yeah.
Just because he's, like, in my head, and, like, I really valued his participation.
You know? Sure. I want to ask about your dog.
Roger. Yeah. Roger is a funny story. So he was found tied up to a fence in Red Hook about a year ago now. And my friend had a shop across the street and saw him out there for about 6 hours and walked over and brought him water a couple times. And then eventually was like, I got to do something
right.
with this dog. Yeah. And, you know, went to a couple other people as fosters. And he's kind of a little, he's, you know, he's like a small pit bull mix of some sort. And he's a little maniac. And I was like, at the time, wasn't really looking for a dog, but I've kind of always had dogs in my life. And my friend Miriam was like, you should take Roger. And I think at his name, at the time, his name was Buddy. And I was like, like, all right, well, I'm going to rename him. Roger's not much better than Buddy, but
yeah. it's,
he's great. He's I try to take him with me everywhere I can and,
yeah.
and spend a lot of time with him. He's, you know, a rescue. He's 2 years old now. A rescue has, he acts as a 2 year old, acts like a 1 year old. So I think, you know, give him another year and he'll act like a normal 2 year old dog and be great.
That's awesome. What is your favorite thing about running your own business?
No one telling me what to do. I think that and the freedom, which is something that you have to create in the business, and a lot of people make that mistake.
That's a really good point.
And I've made that mistake for the first 5 years I was in business, is thinking that you have to do it all yourself and that you're tied to it, and not being able to capitalize on the fact that this is something you have created and you're putting your energy into it, and you put it out, you can take it out however you want. And if that means free time, then you set it up to where you have more free time. I think that's the thing I've learned to enjoy the most out of it. It's like, hey, if I want to take a couple days off, then I figure out how to make that happen. Yep. Whereas if I was sitting in an office, you only get 10 of those a year, you know, or whatever
yeah.
it is.
Yeah. Yeah. So. No, it's sage advice to anyone starting or even running a business. You know, I find that to be one of the biggest challenges in running a business, is taking the time and realizing that it's important to remember that the to-do list is going to be insanely long anyway.
It never ends.
It's never going to end. Never ends. You never get through everything you want to do in a day or a week or a month or a year. So, you know, it'll be there when you come back.
Exactly.
You can take a day off here and there. What's next for Kinfolk? I mean, do you guys have specific plans, or is it kind of things come up and you decide if you're going to sort of move on them and do them?
So throughout the history of the company, we've always been really opportunistic, but we never really created a master plan. We've always just capitalized on opportunity when it's come. Right now, we were supposed to open a place in Los Angeles a couple years ago, and that really set us back because it didn't happen. We made some mistakes, like all business people do, realized we'd put a lot of time and money into a project that wasn't going to happen. So, you know, a year ago, we just said, hey, let's just pull back the reins and really focus on what we have, because we have created something great and we should focus on that. So the last year, and moving probably for the next 6 months or a year, we were really just like, hey, we've got two spaces. We had a third of the time. We have a clothing company. Let's put our energy into those, make those really successful, allow us to go to a position where the next opportunity is maybe something we create, something that doesn't come to us. And we've really focused, like, on ourselves. You know, it's like a introspective. We're just really focused on ourselves right now. And I think, you know, give us 6 months, a year from now, we'll probably start branching out again to do another project.
Cool. And will you ever do a magazine?
I don't think we can. I've thought about that, actually. But I don't know if I would want to. I think if I was going to do some sort of media outlet, I don't know if it would be a magazine. I think we'd try to find something else. I think one idea that I have that I would love to do, I'd like to travel on a dirt bike from New York to Los Angeles.
Oh, cool.
Something I've thought about for the last couple of years, something I really want to do. So I'd like to make a film doing that.
That'd be awesome. Yeah. When I was a kid, I was obsessed with early automobiles. Hmm. And so I used to like read these accounts of like early automobile races. And there was like a New York to LA automobile race in like the 20s.
Oh, cool.
When there were no highways and there were barely roads, right? And, you know, I mean, there was also a New York to Paris race that started in New York and went west and then got on a boat to Asia and then went all the way through Asia and then all the way through Europe to Paris. That's in cool. like sometime in the early 20s. And so reading the accounts of that, of like, you know, they had to take the cars apart to go over the mountains and stuff and like have Sherpas carry pieces. And you're talking about vehicles that are like, you know, not designed, they're not made of aluminum. They're not super light. They're like, you know, truck sized compared to now. And so that kind of like endurance style event, I've always been fascinated by.
Yeah, one of my favorite podcasts is Adventure Rider Radio, and they document people who do those types of trips on motorcycles, and they do it all over the world. It's really amazing. Some really interesting characters come out of that show.
And I think the other thing about doing something like that is that you would have the ability to show it as it really is, right? I mean, there'd be some amazing moments. You'd probably meet some really cool people, but there'd also be some really difficult stuff that happens. And
exactly.
Before the show, you know, we were talking about the whole like the the viewpoint of Kinfolk magazine and how it's kind of it's almost like La Vie en Rose, right? It's like rose-colored glasses kind of thing, or like the van life phenomenon Instagram, right. Where, you know, a friend of mine recently tuned me into an account that exists to sort of counter that is You Didn't Sleep There. That reposts pictures from these people who are showing off this life that just can't possibly be real.
Yeah, it's not real. And it's, if it was real, I don't see how it'd be very enjoyable, because it's, you know, the great parts about life are the parts that aren't perfect.
Yep.
And you want to put out there that, you know, and make people aspirational about some lifestyle that doesn't exist. It's really sad, unfortunately, and people have bought into it, and it seems to work. And a lot of people, you know, I have friends who, you know, have bicycle Instagram blogs that they go take beautiful pictures of their ride, and it's all they take, and they get paid money to do that. And they don't take pictures of the guy with a broken arm being pulled out of the woods,
right? You know?
So yeah, I think if we did a film based on that trip, or when I do a film based on that trip, it'll be as much of the real part of it as possible.
Sure. I mean, in a sort of very dark way, reminds me of the documentary that was made about Apocalypse Now and the making of it. I think it's called Hearts of Darkness, but just about, like, you know, what that was really like to make Apocalypse Now and how hard it was. And based on Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness and all that stuff.
Cool. Yeah, so, I'll take a look at it.
Yeah. Well, I think we've reached the end of our time here this week for Feast Your Ears. Is there anything else, Ryan? Anything going on at Kinfolk? You mentioned the current restaurant that's in there.
Yep, Kitchen's in there. Really, that's the main thing right now. I think we just dropped our clothing line, just dropped this new season. So if you get a chance, stop by there, come have some food. You know, our cocktail program is always pretty good. We always have fresh programming, you know, on the weekends, DJs and live music. So.
Yeah, it's great. It's a great place to hang out. So if you're in Williamsburg, and, you know, I know the hot thing on that corner is to go up to the rooftop bar or the other rooftop bar around the corner, but definitely check out Kinfolk. The vibe is really nice, and it's a good place to hang out. And then you don't have to wait in line to go up an elevator.
Right. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. Thanks, everybody, for listening to Feast Your Ears this week. Big thank you to David Tatasciore, who engineers this show. And you can find Feast Your Ears, as well as lots of other great shows, at Heritage Radio Network. Network.org and on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you get your podcasts. You can follow me on Instagram at TheFoodBaller. Talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.